Well, good morning. I've circulated a revised agenda, I want to take a few minutes to discuss it with you. Before we do that, let me welcome the newcomers to the round table this morning. To David Case's right, Byron Malott, president of Sea Alaska, and to David Getchy's left, Browning Pipestem, who is a practicing lawyer from Oklahoma, and next to Reed Chambers on his left, Cindy Gilday of the Dene Nation, here to Mary Miller's left, Tim Coulter of the Indian Rights Law Center in Washington, D.C. For the benefit of the newcomers and for my own benefit, maybe I could indicate where I think we have gotten to thus far. And to say that I'm grateful to the members of the Governor's Task Force for coming yesterday. They're holding their own hearings today, so they won't be with us. Let me just explain again that I was asked to undertake this job by the Inuit Circumpolar Conference, and they asked me to review ANCSA, to hold hearings, and to write a report. Well, we've been doing that now for more than a year. There have been hearings in 52 villages and towns, and there have been a number of these roundtables, and we are reaching the stage where this report has to be completed. Now, the message from the hearings at which more than 1,000 Alaska Natives have testified seems to me straightforward, and everybody in the state seems to be aware of it. The paramount consideration is land. The people are worried, apprehensive that if there are no changes made to the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, they could, after 1991, lose their land through corporate takeovers. They might, even before 1991 or even afterward, lose it through corporate failures. And in the 1990s, after the period of 20 years immunity from taxation has expired, find that undeveloped lands are liable to taxation. That, of course, would depend on the condition of the state's revenues in the 1990s, but I think you have to regard that as something that has to be taken into account. Now, people are concerned about the fact that children born since 1971 don't participate in the settlement. They have no right to be enrolled as shareholders. They may take shares on the demise of their parents, but not otherwise. There are many complaints about the corporate structure itself as being complicated, out of keeping with Native traditions, and so on. Well, we've all heard about these things, but the paramount question to which people keep returning is the question of the land. They don't want to lose the land. And so we had a roundtable here last month, we talked for 3 days about ways of ensuring that the land remains in Native hands, and we discussed the possibility of restrictions on the sale of shares after 1991, the possibility of issuing shares to new Natives, that is, the children born since 1971. Then, considering the suggestion that is made in many, many places that the corporate structures are not a safe place to keep the land, We looked at the possibility of transferring the land from the corporations to some other entity, and we looked at the land bank, we looked at nonprofit corporations, we looked at cooperatives, and we looked at IRAs. Now, when you go into the villages, the suggestion that is often made is that IRA governments or traditional governments should be the places where the land should be parked, that that's the safest place for the land, and so it should be transferred, many argue, from the corporations to the tribal governments. In Alaska, we have IRA governments chartered under the Indian Reorganization Act, and we have traditional councils, traditional governments that are based exclusively on inherent native sovereignty and do not have any explicit federal recognition under the Indian Reorganization Act. Well, why I thought we should meet now at this round table is to discuss the question of tribal governments and how they would function in Alaska if they were to become the repositories of ANCSA lands, of ANCSA village lands, and conceivably as well of certain regional lands. And it seems to me that this is an important question that deserves to be considered on its own. We've looked at the history of ANCSA, we've looked at the congressional record, we've considered the views of Native leaders who were pressing for land claims in the late 60s and early 70s. We've heard the views of people who worked in Congress at the time. And it seems to me that we should now be looking at the future. What do people here in Alaska want to do about their land? And what measures do they want to take so that they will have something to say about what happens on that land and in their communities? Well, IRAs, traditional councils, tribal governments, are not just places for parking land. They are governments. And that's what I wanted to talk about during this roundtable. And so I've restructured our agenda, and I've suggested that we proceed in this way. I thought that today we could discuss the benefits of tribal government and the barriers to tribal government, and I asked Larry Ashenbrenner of NARF if he would lead off by talking about a functioning tribal government in the Lower 48, specifically the government of the Navajo Nation. Then I have asked some Alaskans to talk about new initiatives in tribal government in Alaska. And I've asked Willie Kasayali to talk about what the people have done in Akiachuk and what it is they're trying to do, what they envision by way of tribal government in the future. I'm going to ask Spud Williams to talk about the initiatives taken in his region when he returns. And I'm going to ask Mary Miller of Bering Straits to talk about this subject too, because as it is one that she has studied and written about. And I hope that as each of you expresses your views, that all of us can join in an orderly way and ask questions and make comments so that we will have a true roundtable discussion. And these names that I've got down here, I put down because I wanted to have something on the agenda that we could pursue. I thought we might spend some time also talking about tribal courts, and I hope that Browning Pipestem will lead that discussion for us, and we will also ask Ralph Johnson to say something on that subject. Then I thought we could ask the people from other countries to mention the steps taken in the field of self-government where they come from. Cindy Gildy from the Denny Nation, Peter Jull could tell us about Nunavut, Frederick Harhoff could tell us about Greenland Home Rule, and Ted Chamberlain, who's just returned from 6 months in Australia, could tell us about developments there. And then tomorrow, and by the way, I hope that we can talk about whether land, if it is going to be held by tribal government, should be held in trust or in fee. I hope we can talk about the whole question of supervision by the Interior Department and the BIA. I hope we can talk about state funding and the barriers to state funding. Are they legal and constitutional barriers, or are they simply barriers that exist in people's heads? And I thought we could talk about the tax question as well. Then tomorrow, I thought that everybody was inclined yesterday to dismiss state chartered governments, but before they are trashed, I hope that we can return to them and see what uses they may have for Alaska Natives. I hope that we can talk a little bit about the North Slope Borough, about the Kativik Regional Government in northern Quebec, and perhaps about Greenland as well, and about other developments here in the state of Alaska. And then tomorrow afternoon, perhaps we could talk about the relationship between native governments that says IRA corporations. I meant ANCSA corporations. I don't know how it came out IRA, but it seems to me that in any future that you can devise for Alaska Natives, you're going to have ANCSA corporations. They are the most visible institution established under ANCSA. They control a great deal of wealth in the state. They employ many people, native people and non-natives, and I think that they are part of any conceivable future regime. So what is the relationship going to be between native governments and ANCSA corporations? How will land be made available for economic development? And what about the subsurface estate? I always bring up the question of the division of the estate between the surface and the subsurface, and I never seem to get anywhere with it. But if people want to address that tomorrow, I hope they will feel free to do so. And then on Saturday, I hope that all of you will feel free to tell me what you think I should say in my report. And yesterday, there was some consternation about the fact that I had brought experts here. Let me just tell you why I've done that. I've held the hearings in the bush. I mean, I think that we only have Bristol Bay to go back to, and we're going back to Bethel. But these hearings will be completed early in the new year. And I have to write a report. Now, I don't want to closet myself with Wilkinson and Johnson and Coulter and all of these, and Chambers and Getches and Case and all these people who've written the book on federal Indian law and on Alaskan native law. I don't want to go into a room and spend time with them hearing their views in private. I wanted them here to say what they've got to say in public, and so that those of you representing the native community whom I've invited here could object to what they say, or just completely out of keeping with what the people here want. So that's why I've tried to assemble this motley group, I hope that in the end, and I repeat this, it's all very well, as some of you did yesterday, to talk about repealing ANCSA, but ANCSA is there. And it seems to me that the objective ought to be to combine the best features of ANCSA, and I mentioned some of them yesterday, with the advantages of self-rule or self-determination or sovereignty or whatever you want to call it. And that's the approach I'm taking, and I think it truly reflects what people have told me at the hearings, and I hope that it is one that in the end will commend itself to Alaska Natives and to and to other Alaskans and other people in the United States. So, having said that, maybe we could start off, and I could ask Lawrence Ashenbrenner to just tell us about a functioning tribal government in the Lower 48.
Commissioner Berger, what may seem perfectly clear to those of us that have practiced Indian law in the Lower 48 may not be that obvious to those in Alaska or Canada. And that is that there is enormous disparity in the practical exercise of tribal government in the Lower 48. It ranges from the Navajo tribe, the largest tribe in the Lower 48, with the biggest territorial area about the size of West Virginia, the largest population, about 160,000, which exercises, practically speaking, more governmental power than any other tribe in the Lower 48, down to some tiny tribes like, for example, the Tunica Biloxi in Louisiana with approximately 200 members, and it has exercised a very small amount of governmental power, but is still recognized by the United States as a tribal power. Let's just look at the Navajo tribe for a moment and just see what it does exercise. The Navajo tribe has 16 departments or divisions of government. It has a police department with countless numbers of policemen, has a fire department, has a mineral resources department, it has a power company, it has a phone company, it has a television company, it has a department of education, forestry, education, welfare, human resources, it has a transportation department for roads, it runs a bus company, it has an air force, and it has a new justice department, which I worked for the last 2 years, with 26 lawyers. More lawyers than the state of New Mexico has in its attorney general's office, and probably as many or more than Utah has, and I don't know the statistics on Arizona. The Navajo Nation covers a part of Arizona, Utah, and New Mexico. It includes a number of counties in those three states. It dwarfs the exercise of self-government power of those counties. If you want to run for a powerful office down in those three states, you run for chairman of the Navajo tribe, or you run for a councilman on the Navajo tribe. You don't run for county commissioner. That's a second-rate office, if you get right down to it down there. So the Navajo tribe exercises and actually conducts itself very similar to a state does, far more similar to a state than to a county, and enters into agreements with cities that border the reservation with respect to water rights, enters into agreements with the state. The chairman, Pete Zaw, recently held a meeting there in Window Rock, the capital of the Navajo Nation, with the governors of the three states. The governors came to Window Rock. He didn't go to Phoenix or Santa Fe or Salt Lake. They came to Window Rock. They entered into agreement which said that, look, we've been suing each other regularly for all these years. Let's try to get along. So before one of the three of us, four of us decides to sue the other, let's give the other person adequate notice and see if we can't settle it before we sue. Rather simple agreement, basically a little thing that you'd think they'd done years ago, but it's worked for the last year. Nobody has sued anybody until they've given prior notice. The chairman of the tribe has entered into similar agreements with the counties and cities, some of them surrounding the area. There you then have the Navajo Nation. Now, I've also, when I worked for NARF in the Lower 48, worked for some of the littlest tribes. I mentioned the Tunica Biloxi, which has about 132 acres of land down in upstate Louisiana in Cajun country that was a forgotten tribe that DeSoto discovered back in 1541, which is they claim the oldest continuous recognized tribe, the one that was discovered first by the Europeans of any tribe in North America, because that is still continuously in existence. Now, that's the Tunica Biloxi's claim to fame, and historically speaking. But the Tunica Biloxi's despite the fact they're 450 years old, or 443 years old from the time of European discovery, and had been forgotten for all those years, and despite the fact that they were the most powerful tribe at the time that DeSoto was there of any tribe in the Southwest, and now had dwindled down to a couple of hundred members, continued to exercise some governmental powers. They continued to decide how their little 132 acres of land would be used, whether it would be leased out or which members of the tribe would be on the home site. They dealt with the local city of Marksville, the chief did, and the chief kept peace on that little piece of land through all these years. And that was about the extent of exercise of governmental powers up until 3 or 4 years ago, when they were formally recognized by the United States government. And the argument was used by some, well, they didn't exercise enough tribal powers to still be considered even a tribe. Well, the Department of Interior rejected that out of hand and said they did exercise enough tribal powers and were a tribe when were formally recognized. Now, this is very recently, and that ought to be somewhat relevant to the dwindling powers of some of the villages and the practical exercise of them. So, and as we all know, or maybe as you don't all know, but the range of the practical exercise of governmental powers ranges all the way then from the Tunica-Biloxi to the Navajo tribe. And there's every other stage of development in between. And just if you want to generalize, and I'm willing to be challenged on this, but I think generally speaking, the smaller the tribe, the less power they actually practically exercise. I think theoretically every tribe in the United States has, with minor exceptions resulting from treaty provisions or particular statutes, with minor exceptions, every tribe in the United States has a theoretical power to exercise all the powers of the Navajo Nation. Practical matter, they don't do it. They couldn't do it if they wanted to. If you only got 200 members, you can't even have you can't have 16 departments and hundreds of subdivisions and so on. But they have those powers. So just having kind of compared the two briefly, there are just a couple of points I would make. I thought somebody said yesterday, I think it was David Case, but somebody said that we don't need a global solution, and I think that's a good point to remember, that as a practical matter, although it might be nice theoretical to have all the power of the Navajo Nation at your command that you could theoretically exercise, as a practical matter, it's totally unnecessary and unwanted and unneeded to conduct the affairs of a very small tribe and to live amicably with their neighboring governments. They simply do not need that power and are happy without it. Secondly, you don't need a global solution, because states, as well as the federal government, have countless times passed laws with respect to individual tribes, tiny little tribes and huge tribes. States, as well as the federal government, have done that. New York has got a whole book of its code, happens to be volume 25, the same as the number on the federal code, that deals solely with New York Indians. And in that, they have separate chapters for the individual tribes in New York. So they have treated with them, and they've dealt with them separately and distinctly as tribes, just as the federal government can do. So it's good to remember that you don't have to put all the natives in Alaska, unless you want to, in the same bucket and have a law applicable to all. It's just not necessary. There's loads of precedent for Congress doing otherwise. I think the last point I would make is that, at least in the Southwest, where I spent the last 2 years, there is far more agreement and a spirit of cooperation between at least the Navajo tribe and I suspect some of the other larger tribes down there, but at least with respect to the Navajo tribe and the states and the counties and the cities surrounding them are far more willing to talk about negotiating jurisdictional powers. Who has the power to arrest, for example, drivers on highways going from Window Rock to Gallup? They enter into negotiations with the state and the counties to work out those things. And there's a willingness to not only negotiate on jurisdictional powers, but with respect to, for example, water rights. Now, the federal government and the state of Arizona and the Ak-Chin tribe and the Department of the Interior recently entered into an agreement which became law, which divided up the water rights down there amongst the state and the city and the tribe, which was ultimately agreed to by all. So when the state of Alaska or some of its officials occasionally seem to reject, or in the past have seemed to reject, the idea that they can't negotiate or enter into contractual arrangements with tribes, they should look, you know, I suggest, to some other states where it's being done, and changing the atmosphere, the formerly pretty racist atmosphere sometimes, into a greater spirit of cooperation. Thank you.
Could I ask you a couple of questions, Larry? The Navajo tribal government, is that an IRA government, or is it a traditional government, or what is it?
No, that is a traditional government. The Navajo tribe rejected the IRA, refused to adopt a constitution, doesn't have a constitution to this day. They simply exercised the power, that their inherent power, and started passing laws. And they have a set of code books, it has about 9 volumes now. Plus, once we ever get it recodified, it may be 20 volumes. But they do not have a constitution, and they are not an IRA.
Do you say they don't have a constitution under the Indian Reorganization Act?
Or any other constitution. They simply do not have a constitution, which means that the tribal council, just like a parliament, I assume, has the absolute ultimate power.
Rosita?
Larry? I have 2 questions. Could you tell us how the Navajo Nation generates revenues? And then secondly, a major concern that we've had up here is BIA oversight. Could you tell us how that affects their resource development?
Well, they get most of their revenue from oil and gas and coal leases, plus governmental assistance from the federal government. And they hope to shortly start implementing their tax program, which is in place and ready to start as of next year. Will be ready, except the Supreme Court accepted the cert on this case, and it's still up in the air whether they will actually be able to implement it that soon. What was the next question?
BIA oversight.
Well, you can't answer that so simply. The BIA, up until very recent years, is the one that negotiated and handled all these leases, which a lot of them were bad leases, the vast majority of them. They did a terrible job in negotiating the royalties and other provisions, and to the disadvantage of the tribe. Now the tribe has its own mineral department, and when these come up for renewal, or if we're able to cancel them, the tribe is doing a lot better job than the BIA did. And in other words, the tribe has just kind of taken over the leasing and control of its own land. And what has turned out as a practical matter, maybe to really answer your question, is that now the BIA rubber stamps the deals that the tribe's negotiating team negotiates, because the tribe has more expertise, more actual, we have civil engineers, petroleum engineers, hydrologists, economists, mineral economists on the staff. So we have more expertise than the BIA does in the field of mineral development. And so actually they just simply rubber stamp our deals. And they, although we have to have their approval, it's a minor detail.
Why do you
it's not like it used to be.
You say you have to have their approval.
Mm-hmm.
So the BIA oversight applies equally to traditional governments as well as to IRA
right.
governments.
That's because of the Indian Non-Intercourse Act of 1790, which says you got to have congressional approval if you're going to, a tribe, any tribe, whether they're IRA or not, is going to give away an interest in land, which a lease is. And so Congress has said the only way you can lease land is get the approval of the secretary. He delegates it to the superintendent down there, and so somebody has to sign off.
Go ahead, Rosita.
With the oil and gas development, who handles it? Is it the tribal government that handles it, or do they form a corporation? Or
no, the tribe handles it itself. Now the tribe is considering turning it over to a tribal enterprise, which would be have a connection with the tribe and be ultimately responsible to the tribe, but it wouldn't be just like a tribal department. Right now, it's handled by a tribal department.
If you turned it over, or if the Navajo tribal government turned over the exploitation of a particular resource to a tribal enterprise, would that be more or less the equivalent of an IRA corporation, a membership corporation?
I think they'd be very similar. The tribe has the Navajo Tribal Utility Authority, which is a tribal enterprise which runs the power lines, the power company. And that's a separate corporation, has its own books, charges customers, and it's an independent entity chartered by the Navajo tribe.
Can it be sued? Can its assets be seized? Or does it claim sovereign immunity from suit and attachment just as the tribal government would?
I can't answer that question. Mm. They had separate attorneys handling that, and I just can't. Maybe some of the other experts here can.
Okay.
I'd like to answer to that, yes. You cannot seize the assets because they're the assets of the Navajo tribe.
I see. Maybe I could ask a dumb question.
Let me clarify that just one point. Is the tribal enterprises that are created there are particular subject matter of the tribe. For instance, the forest that is owned by the tribe, there was a tribal chartered corporation, so to speak, called the Navajo Forest Product Industries, which the forest is placed in its hands. It has a management board that oversees that resource for the Navajo tribe. The creation of the utilities and water and sewer and electricity and things of that nature was then given over to another group that Mr. Ashenbrenner was speaking of, called the Navajo Tribal Utility Authority. Now, the vitality of those organizations depends for its source upon the delegation of power from the Navajo tribe. So, you know, it's still the Navajo tribe's forest, it's still the Navajo tribe's land, it's still the Navajo tribe's utilities, and they've done that in a myriad of circumstances. At one point there was a Navajo Air Force, I mean, it's called the Navajo Aviation Authority. The building of homes was, there was a group for that. Just every single subject matter, you know, the Navajo Tribal Council functions as a government, so that its form of splitting off business activities and making a more efficient operation is to give subject matter jurisdiction, so to speak, over various things that the tribe owns to different tribally chartered corporations, is what that boils down to.
Reed Chambers?
I thought I might mention that there's no reason, though, that a tribe cannot create an enterprise that could be sued, or that would not have immunity. I mean, some tribes have done that. At Fort Peck, for example, the Fort Peck tribe has a tribal corporation chartered, like Browning Pipestem is saying, by the tribe, not by the state, that actually now is the largest industrial employer in the state of Montana. With the copper industry going bust there, why there are 300 members of the Fort Peck tribe that work in an industry there that mainly produces defense contracts. Now that's a tribally chartered corporation. It's called Assiniboine and Sioux Tribal Industries. Now that that business can be sued like other businesses. It has assets that could be attached. It tends to be a successful business. One problem some tribes have had in setting up these separate business entities, which may be of interest to you or you may want to explore further, is that unless you set up some structure that is separate from the tribal governing body, you do tend to get a situation that has tribal politics intervening in it some. For example, one tribe, without going into specifics about it, that we represented ran a grocery business for a while, a supermarket kind of business. That tended not to work after a while because the people running the business were really basically, I mean, the tribal council would intervene with them about who they would hire, who they would give credit to, put pressure on them to give credit to people that, you know, ended up not repaying, and the business ended up ultimately not being able to make a profit and just ceased. I mean, they stopped doing it, failed. So one thing to give some thought to in structuring businesses, I think it's different when you're structuring, essentially the Navajo thing is somewhat government agencies where they're using tribal assets like the tribal forest or the tribal minerals or something like that. But you do have to give some thought to separating the political running of the tribe, the governmental aspects of the tribe from the proprietary aspects. Some tribes have done that under the Indian Reorganization Act by setting up business charters, but not too many, but setting up separate business corporations and having some assets for those. And as I say, at Fort Peck, they've done it by just chartering a separate corporation. The tribe as a sovereign charters a corporation, the tribe owns it, but the assets of the corporation can be attached, are subject to suit, can make contracts, sue and be sued, and so on.
Sheldon and Charlie have some questions too, but let me just pursue this for a moment, if I may. What about the business that Larry Ashenbrenner mentioned, that the Navajo Nation makes contracts with the state governments surrounding the Navajo reservation?
All large tribes do that, Tom. Yeah, I mean that's. I mean, I think Larry's right that the Navajo tribe, because it is larger and tends to have a larger organizational apparatus, may do it more. But for example, we're just in the process at Fort Peck in negotiating exactly that kind of an agreement with the state of Montana about picking up of drivers, arresting drivers on the highway. If they're Indians, the tribe does it, and certain things happen to the Montana driver's license if there's certain kinds of offenses, and it goes to tribal court. And if they're non-Indians, why then the state does it. If a tribal police officer gets cross-deputized to pick up a non-Indian, why he ultimately ends up taking the license and taking it into state court and issuing the citation to the state court. And if a state officer picks up an Indian, why he ends up issuing the citation to tribal court. So that all over the country, Indian tribes are making agreements with state jurisdictions all the time like this. And they have to. I mean, they can't function otherwise.
Sheldon.
I have a question regarding, you mentioned something about the taxing program of these tribal governments down there. These are all related to tax. What kind of tax program are they implementing? Are they taxing industries such as oil and gas? Do they tax property, and if so, whose? Do they have a sales tax, or do they have an income tax?
Well, right now they've got two taxes, what's called a possessory interest tax, which just affects the oil and coal companies and uranium companies if they were still in business. And there is also a business activity tax, which again only affects people, I think, that have a gross income of over $250,000 or something like that a year. So it effectively eliminates every other business on the reservation except the coal and oil companies. There's talk of perhaps implementing some other taxes, but I don't think they're seriously considering a sales tax because they don't at the moment. But those are the only two in place.
Are also over and above this, are they required to pay state and federal income tax?
You're not. Individual members of the tribe are not required to pay federal income tax if I'm going to defer the answer to that question because there's other people know more about taxes than I do. Let's let somebody else answer.
One last question. It seems to me that the Navajo Nation seems to be well on their way toward self-determination. You mentioned 16 departments of their government covering everything from police and fire departments all the way to education. Now, my question is, in 1971, was in fact the Navajo Nation functioning like this? And if so, why was that not brought to the attention of those people negotiating ANCSA?
Well, I'd say the answer is essentially it was. The Navajo tribe has been essentially, it was essentially the same as it is now. There's some improvement, essentially the same.
Browning Pipeston, did you want to add something about this taxation question?
Let me add something from a slightly different perspective. I'm from Oklahoma, and my firm represents several Indian tribes in the state. And in my view, there are no little Indian tribes. There's Indian tribes and there's Indian tribes. And the nature of what they function and what they choose to do as a people really becomes an affair of the heart first. They must decide where they stand with respect to things, because the exercise of what's being bandied about of tribal self-government or sovereignty or whatever becomes a function of the heart. Now, then it becomes a function of what can we realistically do and what kind of things that we can handle. Now, let me give you the example. And what I always think is interesting is every time we have an example, we have an example of the Navajo tribe. Now, I worked for the Navajo tribe in the development area back in the 70s, but let me give you the example of the Sac and Fox Nation in Oklahoma, which is probably a whole lot more applicable to what I see of people here in Alaska. And I feel a kind of a certain kindred to the Alaskans, because there is also, at the same time that there was an Alaska Native Welfare Act, there was an Oklahoma Indian Welfare Act. And what I think is interesting about that is there are no Oklahoma Indians. That became a special designation to denote a fifth class kind of a legal status of those tribes. And over the years, the fifth class legal status resulted in certain assumptions about those tribes, about how, well, just plain bluntly, about how sorry and little and scroungy that they were. That they were nobody, and that they were going to be treated as nobody. And the functioning nature of that has, I guess I could report to you, has changed significantly. Now, the Sac and Fox tribe is a tribe of about 2,000 people. They have a limited amount of land, and about 3 years ago, they decided that they were going to function as a government rather than a social services provider type activity like a nonprofit corporation. Since that time, they have passed what they call the General Revenue and Taxation Act of 1982, which, to my understanding, the Navajo tribe has never collected a dollar, nor have they spent a dollar on their oil and gas severance tax. I can report to you that the Sac and Fox tribe has collected and spent the oil and gas severance taxes that they have collected. They have 11 different taxes that range from motor vehicles to sales tax, to taxes on cigarettes, to a tax on bingo. I don't know whether they have bingo in Alaska. One of the largest money makers for Indian tribes in the lower 48 is bingo. Indian bingo is successful simply because of the nature of the jurisdiction. And the tribes prescribe for larger prizes, and people come in droves. The tribe of which I'm a member is has the largest single bingo operation in the world. Has a bingo hall that seats 7,000 people. There's been several millions of dollars that have run through that. People fly in. They have a busing system from several states. You know, you can talk about little tribes if you want to. Little is a function of the heart. Now, you can be little or you can be nobody. But the nature of the power to say that a people have the similar powers to the Navajo tribe who have millions of acres of land and a tribe who is limited in what it has, that is happy with that, I think I have problems with that understanding.